We see what the occupation did in Syria. Also, we see what it did in Iraq. I believe that the more the atrocities that are committed, the more our resistance fronts are getting more strengthening,
Okay.
more, and will be able to expel this terrorist temporary regime from our region.
Okay, and on that note, I'd like to thank both of you for being with me, but we're out of time. Out of Hamilton, Ontario, Ken Stone, Executive Committee Member, Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War, and Executive Committee Member, Syria Support Movement. And out of Beirut, Sandaz Salassat, Lebanese journalist. A pleasure having both of you. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hasha. Goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. And now we enlighten you with verses 97 to 99 of chapter Nisan from the Holy Quran, recited by Hashim Rouhani.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Innal ladhina توفاهم الملائكة ظالمي أنفسهم قالوا فيما كنتم قالوا كنا مستضعفين تضعفين في الأرض قالوا ألم تكن أرض الله واسعة فتهاجروا فيها فأولئك مأواهم جهنم وساءت مصيرا إلا المستقيم المستضعفين من الرجال والنساء والولدان لا يستطيعون حيلة ولا يهتدون سبيلا فأولئك عسى الله أن يعفو عنهم وكان الله عفوا غفورا صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Surely as for those whom angels cause to die while they are unjust to their souls, they shall say, "In what state were you?" They shall say, "We were weak in the earth." They shall say, "Was not Allah's earth spacious so that you should have migrated therein?" So these it is whose abode is hell, and it is an evil resort. Except the weak from among the men and the children, who have not in their power the means, nor can they find a way to escape. So these, it may be, Allah will pardon them, and Allah is pardoning, forgiving.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
A young Palestinian man succumbs to his wounds hours after being shot by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank. Pakistan's former Prime Minister Imran Khan is set to appear in court following clashes between his supporters and security forces this week over an arrest warrant against him. Also ahead, Russia dismisses as meaningless the move by the International Criminal Court to issue an arrest warrant against President Putin. Thank you for joining us. Our top story, Israeli violence has claimed the life of another Palestinian in the occupied West Bank. The regime's forces opened fire on a Palestinian man near the city of Ramallah. The man was identified as 23-year-old Yazan Omar Jamil Khazab. He succumbed to his injuries in the hospital. The Israeli military claims Khazab tried to stab the regime's troops. Israeli forces and settlers have ramped up their violence against Palestinians in recent months. The latest death brings to nearly 90 the number of Palestinians killed across the West Bank this year. 17 of those were children. Palestinians across the West Bank and Al-Quds have staged a 24-hour general strike to slam the recent killings in Jenin. Our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandil, joined us earlier to shed more light on the killing of a Palestinian youth in the occupied West Bank.
They do not hand his body over quickly to the Palestinian paramedics, but they immediately after his death handed his body over to Palestinian paramedics. As you have mentioned, the number of Palestinians who had been killed by the Israeli soldiers since the beginning of this year is today 89 Palestinians, including some 17 Palestinian minors and children, were shot dead by the Israeli forces. Israeli soldiers are always quick to pull the trigger every time, and in many cases, Palestinians were killed in cold blood on mere suspicions. And at the end of the day, it was clear that they were killed in cold blood without doing anything. But as usual, the Israeli soldiers know very well that they would not be dragged to be prosecuted or to the Israeli courts, and they are supported by the Israeli military establishment, so it's easy for them to shoot and kill Palestinians, claiming that those Palestinians had been attempting or planning to attack Israeli soldiers.
Meanwhile, every year in March since 2005, pro-Palestinian activists directed by the BDS movement hold activities and events against the Israeli apartheid policies. Our correspondent Ola El-Asi reports from the besiege at the Gaza Strip.
The Israel Apartheid Week has started in Gaza and in many cities around the world. This is aimed at mobilizing grassroots support for the BDS campaign to isolate apartheid Israel in the global community, replicating the resistance movement against the South African apartheid.
The killing machine of apartheid Israel.
The week started with a message of solidarity to the Palestinians of the Gaza Strip from Mandela Mandela, the grandson of the South African leader Nelson Mandela.
We feel your pain and suffering and stand in solidarity with you in the struggle against the injustice and brutality imposed by the apartheid Israeli regime. We salute our heroes and martyrs of Gaza and the ordinary men and women, youth and children, who daily face the brutal killing machine of apartheid Israel. You are not alone.
As part of its events, the BDS chose to screen a movie about horror experienced by a Palestinian young girl during the Nakba. The ethnic cleansing of Palestinians by Zionists in 1948.
Well, I think the way Israel reacted to Farha is very typical of Zionist propaganda. They wanted to suppress the Palestinian voice. They didn't want us to tell our own narrative. And I think the best way of confronting this campaign of hate and racism is by producing more cultural products.
Palestinian institutions play an important role in informing people of the history of Palestine through different mediums in order to build a generation that is capable of reclaiming its rights.
I think that the new generation is passionate about learning the truth and the history of the struggle, because during their entire life they have experienced both physical and structural violence perpetrated by the Israeli occupation. They want to know why they suffer, are not allowed to travel, and live in poverty. All this leads them to question the roots of all the problems.
The BDS movement has stressed the need to press ahead with the campaigns against the Israeli apartheid, especially because the regime has intensified its persecution to maintain a system of settler colonial oppression and domination over the Palestinian lives and land.
Recently, we witnessed a growing solidarity with the Palestinian people, especially when the new far-right fascist cabinet took office and Israeli massacre increased in the West Bank. We aspire to reach the international community, not only in the civil global community, to boycott, divest from and sanction Israel.
In Israel Apartheid Week, Palestinians reaffirmed their commitment to resisting occupation, exploitation, oppression and apartheid, like any other people, by all means permitted under the international law and the UN General Assembly resolution, which includes armed struggle. Ola El-Asi, Gaza.
Syria's president says the West is using democracy and human rights as a tool to install puppet regimes in other countries. Bashar al-Assad says the West only classifies subservient countries as democratic. He added that the West seeks to turn others into subordinate states that satisfy its demands, even at the expense of their own nation's interests. Assad also addressed the Russia-Ukraine war. He said the West has been trying to weaken Russia for many years, and this has nothing to do with the issue of Ukraine and Crimea. The US and its NATO allies have thrown their full support behind Ukraine in the war. That includes providing it with military intelligence and financial aid while imposing sanctions on Russia. Iran, Russia, and China are holding a joint maritime exercise in the northern part of the Sea of Oman. On the first day of the main phase of the drill, the naval forces of the participating countries were involved in maneuvers and tactical practices. Our correspondent Mehdi Abbasian has more.
The main phase of Iran, China, and Russia joint maritime exercise, dubbed Combined Maritime Security Belt Exercise 2023, has kicked off in Iran's territorial waters in the north of the Sea of Oman. In the first part of the exercise, different units of Islamic Republic of Iran's Navy, the Islamic Revolution's Guards Corps Navy, and participating vessels of Russia and China conducted different types of maritime exercises.
Today we have successfully conducted joint tactical and operational exercises. In this drill, in addition to joint operations and tactical training and other planned activities, we have had shooting exercises in day and night, photo acts and communication training. We had perfect synergy in conducting the joint drill with Russia and China.
First, the night shooting operation at aerial targets, which is one of the most important naval exercises, was successfully carried out by the participating units. After that, the naval units practiced Morse communication. In the morning, vessels of Iran, China, and Russia, led by an Iranian destroyer, fired at predetermined surface targets in the sea. At the end of the day, the Navy units of the three nations conducted the photo X exercise, including the formation and arrangement of the offensive. Iran says this trilateral exercise would improve the maritime cooperation of the participating countries.
Conducting this maritime exercise with other world powers shows that the Islamic Republic of Iran has the ability to synergize aligned powers and uses this ability to ensure maritime security.
The helicopters of the Navy of the Islamic Republic Army and the IRGC supervised and aerially monitored the region in all stages of the exercise. This maritime exercise is aimed at deepening cooperation among the navies of the participating countries and ensuring sustainable security in the region. Mehdi Abbasian, Konarak.
Pakistan's former Prime Minister Imran Khan is set to appear before the High Court in the capital Islamabad later in the day. That's according to his lawyer in Lahore. Imran Khan is accused of unlawfully selling state gifts given to him by foreign dignitaries when he was Prime Minister in 2018 to 2022. He denies any wrongdoing and had repeatedly refused to attend hearings on the case, citing safety concerns. Khan decided to show up in the High Court on Saturday after it cancelled an arrest warrant against him. The warrant triggered clashes between security forces and Khan's supporters in his hometown, Lahore, earlier this week. The legal proceedings against Khan began after he was ousted from office in a parliamentary vote early last year. Since then, he has been holding protests across the country, calling for early elections. The government has so far refused his demand. Nazar Kazmi is our correspondent in Islamabad and joins us now. Nazar, what's the latest on the matter regarding the former prime minister?
Well, we have received report that Mr. Khan, the former prime minister of Pakistan, will leave Lahore in a few minutes because he is coming by road to Islamabad, and it will take around 4 to 5 hours to reach in Islamabad. And this evening he will appear before the court in Islamabad. Yesterday we have seen that he have received a protective bail in Lahore when he appeared in Lahore High Court yesterday, in the presence of thousands of his supporters who were protecting him when he was going to the court, when he appeared before the court. So today we have seen the similar images that thousands of Imran Khan supporters are gathered outside his residence in Lahore, and he is supposed to come to Islamabad this evening. And we have seen in Islamabad there riots police and thousands of police troops have been deployed in all entry and exit points of Islamabad. The government is have arranged high alert security protocols in Islamabad. So this is, I mean, when the former Prime Minister of Imran Khan is coming to Islamabad, one thing is clear, that police will not manage to arrest him because he is on protective bail for a week time. So today, the administration of Islamabad and the government here, they have imposed Section 144 of the Constitution, which means that there are ban on rallies, there are ban on gathering of people inside Islamabad as well as in the sister city of Rawalpindi. Imran Khan, we have seen that since he is out of power since April last year, he is marching on the streets. He has been holding protest demonstration all around the country, and his popularity graph, no doubt, has went record high in last months, especially when right now the government attempted to arrest him from his residence in Lahore and lodged several cases against him. But the PTI administration and the Khan, the former prime minister, is of the opinion that this government is afraid of election and they don't want to hold general elections in the country. That's why they are afraid of their defeat from him, and he is ready to contest in the general polls in Pakistan. So the scheduled time for these general elections are in October, but apparently it seems that the Pakistani government is reluctant to hold these fresh polls, which is that's why Imran Khan is marching on the streets. He is asking for the government. He wants to pressurize the government. But at the moment, the arguments which came from Imran Khan, that why he is avoiding to the courts, because he is afraid that his life is under serious.
We don't appear to be having Nazar. We'll try and get him as soon as possible to get the latest on Khan's supposed apparent appearance in court today after several weeks of delays due to opposition by the former PM regarding attacks against him. Now, North Korea says hundreds of thousands of its citizens have volunteered to join or re-enlist in the nation's military to fight against the United States. According to North Korea's state newspaper, 800,000 students and workers across the country expressed their will to counter the U.S. The report said the number of people willing to enlist is just for Friday. This comes after the country launched its largest ever intercontinental ballistic missile on Thursday. Pyongyang said the Hwasong-17 missile was launched to demonstrate what it called a tough response posture amid the ongoing military drills by the U.S. and South Korea. North Korea considers the exercises as acts of hostility and a rehearsal for an invasion of its territory. Moving on, an attorney for former U.S. President Trump has been ordered to testify before a grand jury probing Trump's handling of classified documents related to his time in office. The ruling, issued by a federal judge, requires Ilan Korican to provide additional testimony. That's because his communications with Trump may have been related to criminal conduct. Back in January, Korkaran declined to respond to investigators' questions, citing attorney-client privilege. Now, the latest ruling has removed the privilege, considering a crime fraud exception. The U.S. Justice Department is investigating Trump for keeping classified defense records at his Florida home. He has denied that, accusing the department of a witch hunt against him. Following the latest rulings, Trump spokesperson said they will fight the Justice Department. That brings an end to world news for this hour. Thank you for staying with us.
When the whole world is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite, words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord and Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me, in full, in the days gone by. O, the Most Merciful.
In the limelight.
In the U.S., the Justice Department has launched an inquiry into the sudden collapse of Silicon Valley Bank. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. The Justice Department has opened an investigation into the circumstances surrounding the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank, just days after it was taken over by federal regulators to stem a bank run that threatened to spread across the U.S. banking industry. Federal law enforcement officials on Tuesday, 14th of March, confirmed the investigation into the bank's collapse, and the probe is said to be in its early stages. The officials spoke to CBS News on condition of anonymity due to the sensitive nature of the investigation, which was first reported by the Wall Street Journal. The Justice Department declined to comment. California regulators took control of Silicon Valley Bank last Friday, 10th of March, after depositors scrambled to withdraw tens of billions of dollars in deposits over fears that the bank could become insolvent. The spreading panic prompted regulators in New York to seize another institution, Signature Bank, on Sunday, 12th of March. The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation assumed control of both banks and said on Sunday that all depositors would be made whole, including those whose deposits exceeded $250,000 limit on funds backed by the federal government. The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, FDIC, used an exemption in federal law that allows the government to insure deposits above the limit if failing to do so would pose a broader risk to the economy. Silicon Valley Bank's failure was the second largest bank collapse in U.S. history and the largest since the global financial crisis of 2008. The bank was the 16th largest in the United States, with $210 billion in assets. President Biden and his aides have sought to reassure the American public about stability in the banking system, and the president vowed to get to the bottom of what caused the collapse. There are important questions on how these banks got into these circumstances in the first place, Joe Biden said in remarks on Monday. We must get the full accounting of what happened and why so those responsible can be held accountable. In my administration, no one, in my view, no one is above the law. The website of National Public Radio, NPR, has also covered this story and tells us more. The Justice Department has launched an inquiry into the sudden collapse of Silicon Valley Bank, according to a person with direct knowledge of the investigation. Federal prosecutors are starting to ramp up a probe into the doomed Silicon Valley Bank just days after a bank run led to its swift collapse. In response, the Biden administration took extraordinary measures to shore up billions of dollars in deposits to contain contagion from spreading across the banking sector. While the exact nature of the investigation remains unclear, a source familiar said a formal announcement from the Justice Department is expected in the coming days. According to former federal prosecutors, one area that may intrigue Justice Department lawyers involved shares sold by top company executives just before the bank imploded. Silicon Valley Bank Chief Executive Officer Greg Becker sold $3.6 million of company stock just 2 weeks before the bank reported massive losses in the run-up to the bank's implosion, according to regulatory filings. A top company executive engaging in a significant financial transaction so close to a cataclysmic event makes sense as something that would be interesting to prosecutors, said Tamara Matthews Johnson, a former Justice Department lawyer who is now in private practice. The sale has triggered new scrutiny of CEO Greg Becker and prompted some politicians to call for him to give the money back. Greg Becker has not been accused of any wrongdoing in connection with the stock sale. Becker did not return NPR's request for comment. On Friday, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, FDIC, seized the bank, which had some $175 billion in deposits. The vast bulk of the accounts were uninsured. Federal Deposit Insurance generally only guarantees up to $250,000. Treasury officials intervened and waived the cap in order to fully backstop depositors from an insurance fund backed up bank fees. Although officials said the plan to rescue the bank did not include taxpayer money and did not help the bank's management or investors, experts have called the intervention a bailout. Silicon Valley Bank, which was highly concentrated in the technology startup and venture capital world, had for some four decades been a centerpiece of the venture-backed startup economy. The demise of the bank has sent shockwaves across the technology sector. Startups who were facing financial challenges before the bank's failure are now bracing for them to be exacerbated. While the federal government's actions to support uninsured deposits provided a ray of hope for customers of the bank, uncertainty persists among companies in a day since regulators announced the rescue deal. Before officials in Washington unveiled emergency steps to protect Silicon Valley Bank depositors, outspoken venture capitalists and leaders in the startup community pleaded with the government for a safety net for depositors, forecasting a doomsday scenario for the technology industry in the absence of federal action. The British newspaper The Financial Times has also covered this story. US prosecutors are investigating the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank after a dramatic outflow of customer deposits from the California technology lender led to the biggest US bank failure since the global financial crisis, according to a person familiar with the matter. The Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC, has also launched an investigation into the lender's collapse, according to media reports. The investigations, which were first reported by the Wall Street Journal, include looking into stock sales made by Silicon Valley Bank staff in the days leading up to the lender's fall. On 27th of February this year, less than 2 weeks before regulators closed Silicon Valley Bank, Gregory Becker, the bank's chief executive, exercised options on 12,451 shares at a cost of $105.18 a share and immediately sold them at prices ranging from $285.27 to $289.05, according to SEC filings. Silicon Valley Bank's chief financial officer, Daniel Beck, sold 2,000 shares at $287.59 a share on the same day. Both transactions were executed under what is known as a 10b5-1 trading plan, which allows officers to divest stock based on a predetermined schedule filed with the SEC without violating insider trading rules. The scheme has been adopted in January. The Department of Justice's probe into the implosion of Silicon Valley Bank is at an initial stage and may result in charges. Gary Gensler, the chair of the Securities and Exchange Commission, said in a statement on Sunday, without speaking to any individual entity or person, we will investigate and bring enforcement actions if we find violations of the federal securities laws. The Department of Justice has declined to comment. The probes come as U.S. regulators scramble to contain fallout from the Silicon Valley Bank debacle and stave off fears of contagion throughout the banking sector. The U.S. Federal Reserve on Sunday announced an emergency lending facility that will provide additional funding to eligible lenders in order to help assure banks have the ability to meet the needs of all of their depositors.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Eyes of Truth.
Palestine is of great importance to the world's media because of the events and developments that take place there every day. The Israeli occupation leaves no room for the Palestinians to spend a single day without inconveniences, and it does it through various means of repression, murder, confiscation of land, and desecration of sacred sites. And it makes it look like the Palestinians are the bad guys and the Israelis the good ones. This campaign of deliberate misinformation continued for decades until the day came that the Palestinians could provide a narrative that debunked that of the occupation. Through local media, they reached out to the world, communicating their message, all the while aware of the risks involved.
As we know, there are a number of attempts to control countries by occupying the headquarters of television or the occupation of public broadcasters. Israel was working on this aspect, to hit the Palestinian media from the first moment through the creation of fear. These steps have failed as of the start and middle and end of this operation because Palestinian media was ever present, always at the scene. They plan for every upcoming Israeli operation, and the way we can tell something is going on is when Israel starts to attack or bomb the media and bring about fear and confusion.
Israel's branding of itself before the civilized world is a civilized and developed country with a national humanitarian project. I think the Palestinian press has managed and operated first and foremost based on a national theme dedicated to the homeland and national responsibility. We portray the image as it is. When Israel targets civilians and children, bombards houses, mosques, hospitals, organizations, and besieges an entire people, we inform the civilized and free world about what Israel is doing. O civilized people and free nations, this is what Israel is doing to us.
What distinguished Al-Aqsa Media Channel in this war was the influence it had on the Zionist front. We were able, by the grace of God Almighty, to infiltrate Zionist media channels and broadcast to the resistance. As you know, the Zionist government and media follow Al-Aqsa Space Channel, and this is confirmed by a Zionist analyst. We could enter homes outside Palestine on TV and radio and show how the resistance succeeded. And this got into the minds of the Zionist enemy within their own homes and influence their policies as part of the psychological warfare that took place in the 2014
war. This is what the Zionist occupation did not want their own people and the people of the world to see, that the Palestinian press has credibility over the news coming out of the Zionist press, which came from statements made by Israeli settlers. They don't have credibility, but the people believe Palestinian media, and this is the fruit of our determination and perseverance.
يعني هذه النظرية لم تأتي من فراغ بل أتت من مثابرة وأتت من تصميم.
the Israeli occupation and its army first tried to keep the media away from the scenes of carnage during the 2014 Gaza War. But when that didn't work, they went after the journalists. Some of the most important facilities destroyed by the Israeli occupation in 2014 were the five Al-Aqsa Media Network facilities.
The headquarters at Burj Al Shuruq Financial Management Office, the offices at Al Nasr, and the office you are at now were all targeted, as well as the broadcast center.
We all felt like this was the end of us when the broadcaster was targeted. But we don't believe that we are more important than our children and our homes, and the future of Palestine and our feelings do not shy away from embarrassment. Our purpose is that our message to the people should not be disrupted, because we believe they need us every second. We were back on air after a few hours of the attack, which was met with a positive response from the community.
The Al-Aqsa Media Network had aired resistance operational information that allowed the Palestinian resistance to defeat a group of Israeli soldiers. An operational failure for Israel was not an option, and so they had to put a stop to the leaking of the truth to the outside world, and then to replace the truth by way of omission or denial.
Repeat with me, Allah the Almighty, Allah the Almighty, Allah the Almighty. No true God but Allah. Al-Qassam brigades have just captured a soldier. Allah the Almighty, Allah the Almighty, praise to be Allah. Let those wounded people at Al-Shaja'iyah rejoice tonight as Al-Qassam brigades captured the soldier.
Those words that prompt me to stand and salute Ez al-Din al-Qassam brigades and the souls of their hero martyrs, I greet you from the heart. This is a victory speech that we have started sharing on this blessed night. All respect and salute is due to the Ez al-Din al-Qassam brigades. We will start commentating after a short interval. Stay tuned.
That which was reflected through this war, that the Palestinian narrative is credible when it comes to news, we were keen about that. When the Zionist enemies said that five people were killed, we would replay the same information, but without exaggeration of such, reporting that in fact 50 were killed, and we believed that the narrative of the resistance that we knew was genuine. When the Qassam Brigade said they killed 8 Israeli soldiers in Nahal Az, we published it, and this was validated by the Zionist enemy later when they were forced to then confess that indeed 8 of their soldiers were killed. We believe the resistance narrative because they are entitled to be believed.
We believe we have a revolutionary privacy that distinguishes us from others. Frankly, we all received threatening letters to the order that several houses of colleagues were pounded with bombs. One of our colleagues in radio was bombed directly by an F-16 fighter jet. This man was a journalist who was not engaging in any resistance but targeted due to his employment.
The Al-Aqsa Media Network was but one of 19 media organizations broadcasting from the Gaza Strip, which were bombed, leaving them partially or totally destroyed. Al-Shaab Radio was one such network building reduced to rubble.
We tried to take with us some devices, such as a transmitter, which is an expensive device that a radio broadcast relies on. I remember at one time, a colleague started to walk upstairs when all of a sudden, an unmanned drone fired rockets at our building. We had to escape the building with no time to take anything with us, not even archives or any electronic device. Conditions were extremely bad when we were leaving, as some were injured due to the panic and stumbling around at 3 o'clock in the morning, seeing nothing in front of them. The tower we worked in after being hit collapsed into debris. When we couldn't grab anything from inside the radio station, we thought we had lost our important archives. We believed we had lost a voice for the people, months of work.
Another Palestinian media organization assaulted by the Israeli forces was a national agency which provides services to local and international TV stations. This particular site was filmed by a surveillance camera while under attack by Israeli warplanes that let fly several missiles, which decimated the area, compelling and hard evidence of a war crime.
We were offering round-the-clock coverage of the deadly night, which they targeted more than 30 houses throughout the Gaza Strip. Many people were displaced from their homes in the north and in El Shajaya. We're not targeted as journalists individually, but they bombed our whole building, bringing it down with three missiles. It means the occupation is trying to silence media, audio and images. It's a crime. They want to kill the journalists in one hit. There were 36 journalists inside the building at the time. They targeted the building with no prior warning so that we had no chance to evacuate the building beforehand.
It's natural for journalists to be frightened, cautious, and not want to stay long in places that clearly are a potential target of Israeli missiles. Many evacuated from their news desks and resorted to working out of hotels in their continued efforts to write and prevent their words and video footage from being silenced by the invading Israeli forces.
I come from Khan Yunis city. I had to move to Gaza because of the very harsh security situation. As a journalist, I come to stay in a hotel where I am sure I can provide the needed life and life coverage services to the to Press TV. I was injured in one in the morning. I was attending my work. I was doing this work in an area that is known to be full of journalists from the different media outlets, including some foreign journalists who are doing some live coverage and media coverage in general for some international and regional media channels. This is the area where I was targeted and injured. And where I sustained my injuries, I tried my best to stay awake. I tried my best also to establish what was happening, but it was far beyond my capacity because of the very strong explosion and because of the surprise and because of the injury.
Palestinian journalists continued to deliver audio and video reports during the war that so displeased the Israeli government and military, it issued a statement which Palestinian journalists interpreted as a preface to direct targeting.
What happened is that Israel, prior to targeting the first journalist in the Gaza Strip, Hamid Shahab, through their media office, issued a public statement ordering foreign journalists who had entered the Gaza Strip to go to the beach hotel for sanctuary. We issued an immediate statement telling Palestinian journalists that it meant they were being targeted as long as they were not included in the statement. That was our perception of this.
On the eve of July 9, 2014, the first Israeli aerial bombardment took place in what is considered the high-class neighborhood of Al-Rimal in Gaza City. The target of the raid was an automobile carrying a sign that read "Press" on it and driven by journalist Hamid Shahab with co-worker Hatim Selmi at his side. They had stopped by Hatim's home to briefly check on his family, whom he had not seen in a while. Shahab remained in the car outside. A minute or two later, while Hatim was with his family, a missile hit their home, and Hamid Shahab lost his partner.
I was at the office working for the fourth day in a row without going home. I went then, returned home, had a bath, and changed my clothes. I saw my family, but decided not to see my mother as I knew she would become too emotional. You know how mothers get after their sons are away for a while. Hamid phoned me to say he was coming to my home. I went to the balcony to watch for him, but he said he couldn't see me. He told me he was entering the street, and I was looking down both sides to find him. He entered from the Kazim area, from the opposite lane, because he was coming from Al Sabra neighborhood. So he said he is now in the street, and I told him I saw him and ended the call. I was going downstairs. My mother was there, and she commented that she had not seen me in a while and that she missed me. I was touched and moved back to kiss her hands and head, and I was about to hold my brother's hand when there was a huge explosion.
It was Ramadan, and we were leaving the mosque after Taraweeh prayers. We sat with my cousins and a few uncles next to a press vehicle. Another car parked behind us to pick up Hatim Selmi, a journalist who was upstairs. The driver's mobile rang, and the next thing I was aware of, we all woke up at the hospital.
I held one victim in my arms, but he was lifeless. I moved to the next, and they too were dead. Then another and another. I wanted to work my way through those that died so that I may find someone alive to rescue. The injured I could help. The driver was nowhere to be found. The car was unrecognizable. The explosion was so severe. I searched for the driver, but found nothing until a first aid officer found his legs and half of his abdomen. The car suffered a direct hit. It was indeed the target. I imagined myself sitting next to him when the explosion occurred, cut to ribbons, dying together as martyrs.
As the war on Gaza continued, the targeting of journalists too continued and escalated. Israeli occupational forces assassinated 6 journalists, all in 1 month, prompting many other journalists to go into hiding.
I would often warn him, but he always insisted on venturing out to film and record the truth for the world to see. It was in his blood, and he worked passionately day and night. The only time you knew he was alive was when he would call and tell us he is in a certain place and safe.
He would film the martyrs and help carry the injured on his searching to find them all. He used to come home asking about me and my day. He hid his blood-stained clothes from me because he knows I have high blood pressure and diabetes. He didn't want me to feel upset.
Rami was very courageous. Whenever I saw him putting on his helmet and vest, I would ask, "Where are you going?" He would say he was going to do his job and show the truth to the world. I reminded him that we have young children that need their father, but he always said, "What's meant to happen will happen. We can't lock him in a room."
Rami Ryan did not respond to calls from his parents and wife to stay home and not cover the war and go out in search of crimes being committed by the Israeli aggressors. Rami is a photographer and an only son. He is married with 4 children, and his job supports them all, the whole family. Rami's family, like other families of journalists, worried incessantly every time a bombing or massacre occurred. It was a traumatic time for all.
I had my child Rami after 14 years of marriage. I spoiled and doted upon him as he was my only son. He married after high school and had 2 girls and 2 boys. I always scolded him, saying he is an only son and all would be lost if someone were to knock on my door and tell me something happened to him. May he rest in peace. He never listened to me. His work was a message he had to deliver, even if the price was his blood. He was prepared to die for the cause.
I phoned him in his last days. He was away so much, and I told him that he needs to come home and spend time with his children, as they missed him so. He promised to come home early that night, and he did come, and we ate dinner together. He showed us some of what he had filmed, horrible scenes from his trips accompanying the PRCS as they evacuated displaced people from Ash-Shaja'iyya.
The last time I saw him, I was in afternoon prayer, and he was about to leave. I raised my voice saying, Allahu Akbar, to make him wait. Then he came to the window side and waited. Once I finished my prayers, I told him that his kids are still young and that because of the risk he was taking, that one day he would die in the blink of an eye. He told me that Allah will look after them and told me that if I locked him in a box, he would die. So it's better that he lives as he was meant to. I told him that he exhausted me with worry, but that he's also right in what he said.
One day, Rami journeyed out to cover a massacre in Ash-Shaja'iyya neighborhood. His photos taken at the site were the last images he ever took. Scores of rockets and missiles rained down on the same area after the initial massacre, and Rami was martyred.
The incident of injuring and killing and murdering Rami Rayyan in Ash-Shaja'iyya neighborhood when the Israeli occupation forces targeted the market, killing with the deceased Rami more than 17 people from Ash-Shaja'iyya neighborhood. That was another evidence that our job is full of risks and that our life is at the stake, but that also that surprised us, but that also made us determined that we are the guards of the truth.
Rami's family lost their son, husband, father, and sole breadwinner. The only consolation for the family members is that Rami died exposing the truth embedded in the photographs he took of the massacres and other crimes committed against the Palestinian people.
May he rest in peace. He has been martyred, which is a privilege. Praise the Lord that he was chosen. He was a kind-hearted and a good man. There is nothing worse, though, than when a child asks you, where is her father? You might answer that he is in paradise, but then the child says, when it rains, dad will get wet, and so he should come here to stay warm with us. You answer that it won't rain on him, as the Lord protects him in paradise, where he has everything.
The war in Gaza lasted for 51 days. By the end, dozens of journalists had been killed or injured. Witnesses to Israel's great loss over its battle to monopolize and control media exposure, which severely damaged its reputation on the world stage. Witnesses to the success of Palestinian resistance in the face of one of the largest and most technologically advanced armies in the world today.
Here there are 7 martyrs and about 30 wounded. Of the wounded, some have permanent disabilities. In every war by Israeli aggression, there's a great sacrifice from the Palestinian media sector, and I can tell you that we have no problem in giving our souls freely to expose the hellish barbarism of the Zionist regime.
We have lost in this war 18 brothers from the family of the press in Gaza. If journalists didn't put their lives on the line to expose Israel's crimes, if they did not succeed in this mission to be the messengers of the occupied peoples, then they would have not been targeted by the Israeli army. I think the Palestinian press succeeded in their endeavors that shows their love for their homeland.
There was a distant challenge this time in that the Palestinian media became a serious counterweapon versus the Western-dominated Israeli media and narrative. We were able to refute their narrative of lies and manipulation of the truth this time. They overrode our signal, but we broadcasted from other stations. When Al-Shaab radio station was targeted, the Al-Quds station was saying, here is Al-Shaab voice from the studios of Al-Quds station. When Watan and Al-Aqsa stations were targeted, we said we were their voice. We made it clear if they targeted one studio that the whole Gaza radio network would all be the voice for Al-Quds or Al-Shaab or any other Palestinian station attacked. We think we succeeded in this battle to make the truth in war prevail and to successfully counter many of the lies broadcasted as Israeli propaganda.
Even if
if a war erupted right now, we will still continue our work. For instance, I'm from the neighborhood of Beit Hanun, where almost every family has been displaced. My family stayed initially in a collective center. Our house was targeted, and thirdly, my place of work at Al-Watania Media was taken out by a missile. It took me just 4 hours to get back to my duties. Every journalist is subject to risks, just as the families and the thousands of children displaced. I didn't see my family for 52 days. Even when injured, I kept on working. Palestinian journalists are fierce workers in their dedication to expose the occupation in all its aspects.
Almost immediately after the war came to an end, media personnel returned to their offices to work, and staff of the destroyed networks found new premises to set up in and continue their brave cause.
As soon as the radio station was bombed by an Israeli airstrike, we were back in the saddle coming up with ways to get back on air reporting events. Even with the loss of the archive and the old premises of Al-Shaab, we started working and thinking of how to revive our efforts despite the sustained risks. Nothing will stop us from our path to serve the Palestinian cause.
Al-Aqsa radio station represented the resistant media, a voice that will never run out of means to continue. We have infinite alternatives and options that the enemy is not even aware of. Our signals will never be permanently ended. With Allah's will, we will return to the airwaves, always, one time more than we are knocked down.
They may have killed or deported journalists, but their pictures are immortal witnesses to all the horrendous atrocities committed by the Israeli occupation on Palestinian soil.